Hello, and welcome to the PC Pro Podcast on the 23rd of January 2020. I'm Tim Danton, Editor-in-Chief of PC Pro, and with me today I have two fine gentlemen, namely...
Hello, and welcome to the PC Pro Podcast on the 23rd of January 2020.
Who is that?
See, that's my fault. You see, now what's happened there is because I'm on a new setup and I forgot to turn my speakers off and all that. Oh, the professionalism of it. Yep. Hello, Tim. I'm Barry Collins.
Yep, are definitely our highly professional duo are joining me here, Barry Collins and also Darian Grosmith.
Hello there, good to have you back from Las Vegas, Tim.
Yes, well, it's good to be back, actually, except it's really overcast and quite cold.
Yeah, I imagine the weather's quite different here.
Yes, I was quite enjoying the sunshine, etc., with the little holiday I shared with John Honeyball at CES. So if you didn't listen to that podcast, it's available on SoundCloud, on Spotify, on iTunes, on all good available platforms. But we are live today, our first live podcast of the year, so welcome to our Mixlr listeners. So let's kick off, shall we? God, I'm so relaxed in the new year. I entirely forgot to bring up my list of stories. Oh, well, yeah, I say relaxed, but Barry isn't going to be relaxed as he tells this one. Go on, Barry, tell us what's making you angry this week.
Well, this is our friends from Sonos, who have got themselves into a spot above over their speakers, Sonos speakers. Basically, I'm sure readers are familiar with them. They're sort of reasonably high-end, although they've sort of come down these days. Streaming speakers, where the whole multi-room setup where you have multiple speakers across your house, at least that's what Sonos would like you to do. But Sonos would also like you to have very new speakers across your house and not so keen on you hanging on to old ones. So this story crept out before Christmas, where Sonos were basically offering a deal to new customers, to existing customers, where they could trade up an existing Sonos product and get a 30% credit on new speakers. The kicker to that was you had to put your speaker into something which they euphemistically call recycle mode. Recycle mode basically doesn't allow you to recycle the speaker at all. It just cripples it. It deactivates it. It basically gives you 28 days before the speaker's permanently decapitated. It won't work. It won't turn on. It's a dead speaker, to nod our friend Mr. Jones. They got a bit of heat over this over the last few weeks. Lots of people complaining that that's not very green in this day and age. That the most environmentally friendly thing to do would be to allow people to reuse the speakers or sell them on. And what Sonos is doing is basically saying, if you want this discount, you've got to turn this speaker into a brick and either take it down to your local e-waste facility or ship it back to us. So that caused a bit of a storm. Then this week, they've sort of updated their... we got a press announcement on Monday that was embargoed, or Tuesday that was embargoed. Everybody thinking they're about to do a U-turn. And it seems they've just sort of dug in here and doubled up. And this is also, this didn't come in the announcement to the press, but in a release to customers, they said, again, announcing end of software updates. And I'll just read it very quickly. It says, in May, the following products in your system will be classified as legacy and will no longer receive software updates and new features. These include the Bridge, the Play 5, Gen 1, and other speakers. Legacy products were introduced between 2005 and 2011, and given the age of the technology, do not have enough memory or processing power to sustain future innovation. Please note that because Sonos is a system, all products operate on the same software. If modern products remain connected to legacy products after May, they also will not receive software updates and new features. So not only is Sonos now, initially trying to encourage people to brick their speakers, it's now saying if you've got an older speaker on the same network as your newer ones that you've paid for, those new speakers won't get any updates either because they're all part of this same system and you're going to be stuck on old software. So that predictably caused a touch of outrage from customers, and I think Sonos is now dying in the Twitter flames.
Yes, it is. But don't you think they have a point in terms of it being a system?
You know, I think they do. And to be fair to Sonos, that it's perfectly valid for a company to retire support for its old hardware in the same way Microsoft retires support for Windows or Apple for Mac OS or whatever. But it doesn't have to go to the extent where it's encouraging people to turn perfectly good speakers, which could be used just on a pure Bluetooth basis or by plugging in an aux cable. You don't have to disable the entire system or the entire speaker to keep that running. And I think, as we're saying, in this day and age and where everybody is hugely conscious of environmental e-waste, to basically encourage people to fill up their landfill with these speakers is a really bad move.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that's the thing that occurs to me is, why not just turn it into a Bluetooth speaker? You know, there's nothing. You just turn it into something dumb. That's fine. Not everything has to be super smart. And one of the reasons why people chose Sonos was because the sound quality from that first batch of smart speakers was very good compared to the opposition. Have you actually got some of these, Barry?
No, I've never bought into Sonos at all, and I'm glad I didn't.
Are you? But you've got Alexas at some point, Echoes rather. At some point, those are going to die.
Yeah, you know, at some point down the line, every piece of, you know, I had this discussion with Paul Lockenden today on Twitter, and he was saying, I made the point that basically retailers should replace the buy button on Sonos speakers with rent, because you only got them for as long as Sonos allows you to have them. And, you know, yes, that's probably true of Amazon speakers and Google speakers and all of them. The thing I would say is they've gone a step further by deliberately crippling hardware. I mean, I've not seen Amazon do that yet. You may well get products that reach end of life and are effectively worthless, but when they're encouraging you to cripple hardware, I think that steps over the mark. In Sonos's defense, I better put their case in the press release they sent to us. They say the reason for doing this is to protect unsuspecting consumers from buying old products with a limited lifespan. what you will.
Really? That's the weakest argument I've heard. What's your take on this, Darian?
Well, I mean, when they say you can't use newer devices and old ones together because it's all part of a system, I mean, that's saying they're kind of conveniently making it sound like that's just the way it naturally has to be. And in fact, that's just bad engineering. They've come up with a system where, you know, things can't interoperate when they're on different levels of the software. But there's no reason for that. I mean, you know, anybody who's done any kind of computing or maybe engineering project in the past, I don't know, 50 years, will know that you modularize you know, what different components can do, and they talk to each other using a standard language. There's absolutely no reason why an older speaker running an older version of the software can't advertise, these are the functions I support, and a newer speaker or a newer hub or whatever can look at it and go, oh yeah, that's running software version 5, so we know it doesn't support this feature, but it does support that feature. I mean, Sonos, I think, is really being very disingenuous here. And it's entirely down to the design of the platform. I mean, you asked Barry when his Alexa devices, when his Amazon Echoes are expected to go end of life. But the thing is, I mean, on an Alexa, all the work, or the vast majority of the work, is done in the cloud. That's a much more robust design, because the thing that you have at home really is quite dumb, and that, you know, it's very hard to see a situation where you're going to want something, some fundamental new feature that's built into the Echo platform that can't be supported by the existing hardware. And that's great. I mean, it may be a challenge for Amazon in the future to persuade people to upgrade, but from a consumer point of view, that's good and smart. And I think Sonos is, you know, it's the opposite. It's bad and dumb.
And the other thing is that it's an audio company. It's perceived as an audio company. And the heritage of audio equipment is that you invest and then it lasts for decades. So that's, I think, the other thing they're battling against.
Yeah, exactly. And also, the Sonos stuff isn't cheap. You know, we talk about the Amazon, but the majority of Amazon speakers in my house cost less than 30, 40 quid. The Sonos stuff, certainly, you know, 5-10 years ago, was several hundred quid. And you don't expect that to suddenly drop off a cliff.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the comments from on Mixlr, and it's not positive reading for Sonos, but as it hasn't been on Twitter, as you say, for quite a while. Southend Site saying, Sonos, a company to ignore forever. John Bennell, I'm invested in Sonos, and we install hundreds a year. So, and Ian Orford, again, saying, I agree with Southend Sites. Sonos is now a company to ignore forever. I only have old speakers, but I still think the software will nag to update and hence destroy all of them, which is probably true based on recent experience.
I'm curious to know what these new features are that Sonos is saying that you won't get in future, because, I mean, what you say about audio hardware being something that you can invest in and keep for decades is true, but, I mean, we have that idea because we're used to the idea of, you know, the 1970s music center or the 1990s separate system, and that still does everything that it was, you know, that it did when we bought it. I just wonder if maybe there's a side to this that we're not seeing because Sonos hasn't yet unveiled its plans for some amazing new feature that we are, you know, we're not privy to. But I can't imagine what it would be.
Can I just read out the products that are going to be affected from May? Because a lot of people on my Twitter stream today are asking if their speakers are going to be affected.
Yeah, so, but your fee for this podcast will be adjusted, you know, based on how much you're just reading out, Barry.
So, from May, the following products are the ones that are not going to receive software updates or new features. They are the original Zone players, Kinect and Kinect Colon Amp, which was sold between 2006 and 2015. There's the Play 5 Gen 1, the CR200, and the Bridge devices. They are all the ones that won't receive updates after May.
It would also be interesting to know how many of these are actually still in use. I mean, the only one of those that had a date on it was 5 years ago. And fair enough, that's, you know, not a very long time, as we say, in audio terms. But it might be that, in fact, such a small number of customers are affected that Sonos has made a massive kind of strategic error in drawing attention to this, whereas, in fact, it could have bought off or just, you know, quietly swept the issue under the carpet because only a tiny number of users would have been affected. I don't know.
Darren, sweetheart, it's the exact opposite. It says in the press release, it says, Sonos is proud to have supported these original products throughout this period of unprecedented technological advancement, and 92% of them are still in use today.
But 92% of those sold, we don't know how many actual things that is relative to the number that have been bought in the past few years.
No, that's talking specifically about the legacy products. 92% are still in use today. So I'm assuming that means 92% of those products I listed earlier are still being used, which means that a hell of a lot of people are going to be affected.
It does sound that way, but that's only 92% of legacy products. It's possible that they've sold 10 times as many in the years since 2015.
Of course, yeah.
So, I mean, it seems very easy to believe, based only on your Twitter feed, that a lot of people are affected, but I'm curious to know, and I guess we never will, you know, the actual scale of it and whether Sonos is foolishly making this a bigger deal than it needs to be.
Okay. All right. Well, let's, for the moment, this may be something we come back to in a future podcast. Let's just draw a veil on that one. And instead, look to the future, Darian, where we all have phones with two screens.
Oh, okay. That's you're rejigging the running order live. This is very exciting. But
I did. This was in Slack, Darian.
Slack.
I only use
Twitter, I'm afraid. Fine, that's cool. No, we can talk about this. It is probably one of the more interesting things that's come out this week. Microsoft has made available an emulator for its forthcoming Surface Duo device. Now, if you remember the Surface Duo, it was unveiled at the Surface Hardware event back in October. It's basically a folding Android phone. Well, so there you go. That's the summary of it. It's got two 5.6-inch displays. It's made by Microsoft, but as I say, it runs Android. And at the time, we were like, okay, fine. Well, you know, Microsoft is jumping on board this this bandwagon. We'll see what comes of it. But they've actually done quite a lot of work in making the user interface, the two-screen approach, make sense, which to me, you know, immediately puts this on a rung above the Galaxy Fold or whatever you want to talk about. So as I say, they've released this emulator so people can start developing apps for a two-screen device before the hardware becomes available. And they've also released a video showing a concept of how this might actually work. And I've got to say, I've been pretty skeptical about dual screen devices. I mean, I haven't said no, they'll never work, but I've also been kind of waiting to be persuaded. There's some good stuff in this video, though. Generally speaking, they keep it fairly simple, and they have one app running full screen on the right hand screen, and then another one running on the left-hand screen, and you can just swipe one away or change one while leaving the other in place. You can bring up a launcher on one screen while keeping the other one there, and then switch between apps. You can drag and drop windowed apps around. You can also, in theory, if the apps support it, drag elements from one screen to the other, drag like maybe a bit of text or a graphical placeholder from one app to another. Or you can have an app that runs with two pages, giving you, for example, a dual view on something, so you can have graphics on one side, text on the other. They've really put some thought into ways that this might actually be useful. There's a video online, which I'll try to find and post on Mixlr, which I've got to say does make it seem like not quite such a ridiculous blue sky optimistic idea as we maybe at first thought it was.
Yeah, actually, go on, Barry, and I bet you're desperate to blast this as a whole idea.
I'm in two minds on this one. I think the whole bendy screen thing is a massive red herring that's never going to take on. I think where Microsoft has been sensible here is to basically say these are two.
Who is
two
pinging? Someone's desktop keeps on pinging.
I don't think it's me, so.
My speaker's off, I think, but I will. Sorry, I will. It may well be me. It sounds like a Mac ping. I thought it was one of you guys. What was I saying? I've completely lost my track. What they've done with two separate screens, I think, is clever because it allows the apps to not have to be completely redesigned. Although they are, I think the reason they've come public on it now is because they're trying to encourage developers to make their apps spread across the two screens, and I think that's a complete non-event that's never going to happen unless these phones really take off and there's huge volume of sales, because developers aren't going to waste time. They must have been bitten so many times by Microsoft telling developers, come on, get on board now, this will be big in 2-3 years time, and it never is. Microsoft has cried wolf too many times there, but I think it's got a hope, I'll put it that way, but I'm not thinking this is the big next thing either.
Yeah, and I see I'm not as cynical as you are about bendy screens, Barry. We are definitely right at the start of this, and it could absolutely fail on its bottom, but the fact that OLED screens now are relatively easy to make and bendy, and they will last for a few years, it just feels like that is something that that we will find a use for. And the Galaxy I can't remember which of you said that the Galaxy Fold is much better idea than the Galaxy Fold. Was that you, Darian?
Yeah, about 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, but you. Why do you think a dual screen is better than the Galaxy Fold?
No, I'm more impressed by it, because when Samsung came out with the Galaxy Fold, I did not see any particular need for it, because it seemed like they were just saying, look, here's a really big screen that you can use to like spread your apps across a bigger area. Whereas Microsoft's done a lot more UX work to kind of come up with ways that you can actually use the two screens to improve your productivity rather than just showing off you've got a foldy screen.
Right. Right. The advantage of having the bigger screen, I would say, boils down to two main things that I see. One is I do see a lot of people reading new articles and Kindles on the train, on the tube. So that's one usage. But then the other thing they tend to do is watch videos, and watching videos on just that little bit larger screen just suddenly becomes much more pleasant than, so I think those are two areas where this, the Galaxy Fold and the Mate X, etc., are a better option than having a twin screen device.
I mean, what I like about the Surface Duo concept is that it's not very ambitious. It doesn't require, as I think Barry said, it doesn't require everybody to go and completely rewrite their apps. I can see myself using it today. One of the things which frustrates me about the smartphone form factor is it's just no good for multitasking. You have to go into one thing and then like go out into this kind of conceptual backstage area where you've got loads of apps running, but none of them is visible except the foreground one. And just having two apps side by side, I can immediately see if that's all it gives me, then I'm still better off.
Yep. Barry, I heard you grunt.
Well, the other thing here is battery life, because if they if you're going to have a dual screen device, you need a dual battery effectively. Otherwise, this thing is going to tear through battery in less than half a day. And I hope that they're going to account for that. The downside of that, of course, is that these things are going to become very thick in the pocket. So I think you're either going to have to sacrifice portability or battery life, and neither of those are great choices.
Let me ask you this. So one of the pieces of technology I saw at CES was an Indiegogo idea called Castaway. And the idea there was that it was a second screen that kind of acted as a cover for your phone as well. So you can scrunch it together. It kind of connects magnetically. And so obviously it bulks up, but it also protects your screen. And that second screen is effectively a Chrome-based tablet. So a mini Chromebook, if you like. But with the software, you can share photos on that, you can throw a video over there, or you can use it completely independently. What about that idea? Is that a winner?
Sounds like the worst idea I've ever heard.
Yeah, what a mess.
But isn't that basically what we're talking about here, you know, with the Surface Duo?
Oh, not at all.
No.
Unless I've completely misunderstood what you're saying.
So if you imagine this, so the Surface Duo is a, you've got a two screen device that's connected mm-hmm. together, one screen on the left, one screen on the right.
Yep.
What all this is an aftermarket version of the same thing.
But it's not running on the same hardware, so you can't just like grab something and move it from one screen onto the other or drag content from one screen to the other.
But you can. So that's
But you said it was a Chromebook.
It's based on Chrome, so it can run independently. But what I'm saying is that you can move things from one to the other. So if you want to share your photos, for example, with your family, then you can use you could even just split off this thing and say, here you go, here are all the photos that you wanted to see. And likewise, if you want to, let's say, watch the football on one, whilst you're typing away on the other, then you can do.
Presumably, it's independent hardware. So basically, you'd have to charge both devices. Yeah. Absolutely out.
But we're moving towards a beautiful wireless charging future, Barry. So
he says, looking at a sea of wires on his desk.
Wireless charging is slow, and you can't use your device while it's charging. And those are pretty big problems that I don't see any solution. Well, I can imagine a solution to the slow, but you know the boffins don't seem to have made that happen yet. I've been banging on about wireless charging for more than a decade, but I'm still not seeing it become a realistic, you know, kind of standard. It's a bonus rather than something that's going to become mainstream.
I think it will gradually seep in. It's on my list of things to buy when I have a, you know, that spare cash is just a wireless charger. And I just slap my phone.
Like £6.
Yeah, I know.
Honestly, I'll lend you the money.
It's my lend. You already can buy it for me.
I'm not generous.
You're quite right. They are in a few pounds. But, you know, it's something I've been thinking about getting, just to have on my desk here, so that I don't have to, because then I just don't need to worry about charging anymore.
Well, as I say, it is slow. You might find that it's quite frustrating. You stick your phone on the charger. And also, it can be finicky. You might stick it on the charger.
Really finicky.
Grab it 2 hours later and find it hasn't charged at all. Or if it has charged, it's only got you up to 30%.
Yeah, I had one on my desk for a year and I barely used it for that very reason. You put it onto it, it lights up and says I'm charging, and then you pick up the phone an hour later and it's less than where you started. It's very fiddly.
Okay, that's poor.
Can I just throw in one other thing about this dual screen business before we, we've already strayed miles away from the topic, but there's just another relevant bit of data that I have, which is Microsoft is also releasing an emulator for Windows 10X next month. And the reason that's interesting is because you may recall back in October at the Surface Hardware event, it also revealed the Surface Neo, which is a dual screen tablet format thing, which runs Windows 10X, Windows 10 on ARM. And And so that opens, well, we don't really know exactly what doors it's going to open in reality, but it suggests that Microsoft is thinking about dual screening as more than just a smartphone thing, as kind of a whole new personal productivity approach. And I'm cautiously optimistic about it.
Yeah, no, people are banging on about it. Microsoft, Intel, you know, they are both very keen on a dual screen future. So we shall see. Okay, let's move on to the next topic. And this is something that Barry and I absolutely 100% agree on. There'll be, you know, we will just talk as one for this next topic, which is Microsoft's introduction of the new Credge.
Yes, this is Microsoft Edge, the version of the browser that has been pretty much redesigned from the ground up to work on the Chromium browser engine rather than Microsoft's own. And there, for me, the excitement pretty much stopped. But one of the big things here that Microsoft is pushing with this, in a very similar vein to Firefox, is the privacy aspect. Vested interests all over the place here, because with Bing having such a visible market share, Microsoft has sort of less incentive to help advertisers. It's more now into the Apple camp of there's no real money in this for us, we might as well make a selling point out of it. So they're beefing up the privacy protections that are in Edge. So if you go into the browser preferences, you'll find a screen that is almost identical to that of Firefox's, where you get to choose between basic, balanced, and strict privacy tracking preventions. It defaults to balanced, which blocks trackers from any sites you haven't visited. Content and ads are less likely to be personalized, and it blocks known harmful trackers, apparently. It's hard to. I've had it installed for a few days. It's hard to notice any real difference at the moment. But you know, it's. I think some move towards boosting people's privacy online is obviously a good thing. Even if you do sort of question why now, Microsoft. One interesting little side note on this is that some of the trackers that get blocked are those from LinkedIn, which Microsoft owns. So they may want to look into their own back garden before they start throwing stones, as it were. But other than that, it is pretty much Chrome. You can there is a sort of the option to install extensions. Microsoft's a bit coy about this, because you can go to the extensions thing and there's a reasonably small library of extensions, but if you delve into the settings, you can actually install anything that's in the Chrome web store. So for example, I use Bitwarden as my password manager. That's not available if you look in the extensions, if you just search the extensions, but it is if you open up the Fuller store. So I'm not quite sure why Microsoft's doing that, because it makes the browser look worse than it is for me. But there you go. But other than that, it's sort of Chrome in a different wrapper. But Tim loves it.
Well, I do like it. And love is a strong word, Barry. I do like it, and the reason that I like it almost is because it is so much like Chrome. So as someone who doesn't really want to delve into all the inner workings of Google's Chrome settings to work out a better set of privacy settings, actually that's nicer. So just with one sweeping move, it's all there. And one of the criticisms you have about it, Barry, is that there's nothing really new in it, isn't it?
Yes, there's nothing new in it.
And I agree that there are no great new ideas, but there are some advantages that I see that it has over Chrome in particular. So for Chrome, you have to... Okay, if you are listening to this podcast, you probably know that you can get an add-on such as Clearly for Chrome, which allows you to have this immersive reader idea. So it strips you're on a web article, and it just means you can strip away all the ads and just start reading it in a kind of something much more akin to an ebook kind of view. But not everyone knows that, and so to have an easy to use version of Chrome that everyone will be able to get, and just be able to click on a little icon and then go into this immersive reader view is good for every consumer, not just someone who's got the technical know-how, to actually get a more balanced set of settings, as opposed to going deep into Chrome settings to check your privacy. That again, I see as a real advantage. And I also like the fact that I like the fact that the new tab is very easy to control. So if you want to have that horrible MSN kind of homepage view, which shows you all these
celebrity clickbaits,
you can now personalize that. You can now choose to have it not there at all. So, for example, I just started a new tab in Microsoft Edge, and I've got a very nice picture of zebras, and I don't know what the others are actually. But
I'll take it back. It's good.
But it's a nice interaction, as opposed to what I had before. So my big criticism is that the one thing Microsoft really tucks away is being able to change the search engine of the Omnibar or the Omnibox, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, the box at the top of the screen where you normally plug in the URL. So the default is, of course, Bing. And to change it, you have to really, you have to delve far more than you should to change it. It should be a one or two button process, but it isn't. And also the default search engine of this new tab, which is just actually a search bar and the picture, that is Bing as well, and that's unchangeable. But you know, I suppose I'm willing to live with that as the cost of doing business with the new Edge.
I bet there's a hack out there somewhere that you can. Someone's already, I'm sure, found a way of changing exactly what that search bar sends. I've been trying. I mean, like Barry, I've been using Edge for the past couple of days, the new version. And like Barry, I'm kind of really struggling to see the point. I think I can see the point from Microsoft's point of view, from an engineering perspective. You know, if they're on a code base, rendering code base, which is already well known and maintained by other people, that's presumably a win versus having their own. I would struggle to really recommend it to anybody. I'd struggle to come up with one reason why somebody should bother switching from Chrome to Edge. I see if you were starting from scratch, then maybe you'd weigh it up and go, oh, Edge has got these advantages. We haven't done the same for Chrome, of course. We haven't sat down and worked out what its little advantages are. But one thing I will say that Microsoft, I think, has done quite cleverly is they've managed to pitch it right, that people like me and Barry and, I'm sure many, many, many other people have gone, oh, okay, let's give it a look. And the more times we give Edge a try, the easier it becomes to imagine using it as your day-to-day browser. When it first came along, I was like, nope, I had my experience with Internet Explorer back in the 90s, and I've had quite enough of that. I settled on Chrome 10 years ago, never seen a reason to change, so there we go, bye-bye Edge, not even going to bother opening you. But gradually, Microsoft have, through incremental improvements, but also just positioning it smartly. And they have annoyed me in some ways. It complains if you try to set Chrome as your default browser, that sort of thing. And yes, its antics with Bing are frustrating. But in general, I find myself very easily able to imagine that if you gave me a laptop that was locked down and I couldn't install Chrome on it and I had to use Edge, I'd be fine. And that's a win for Microsoft.
Yeah, I agree. It's an improvement on what went before. The points you're making a moment ago, Tim, about the improved privacy protection, the reader modes, that's all in Firefox. That's all in Vivaldi. That's all in Safari. These aren't new features. They've been in other browsers for some time. And if you use Firefox, for example, you don't have any of that fuss over the default browser, default search engine. Loads more stuff is customizable. So I'm struggling to see, as Darren says, what the USP of Edge is. It offers nothing that is not available elsewhere, that and done better in some instances.
Yes, but the trouble with technically, I completely agree with you. But the point is that what's Firefox's market share? Is it 11%, something like that? Let's say 10%. So despite in many ways being a superior browser to Chrome, it stayed pretty static at that kind of market share for quite a while. So what I'm really saying is I'm not saying that Edge is a technically superior browser to Firefox, and I'm not saying it's got better privacy features than Firefox, because I think if you care about privacy, absolutely, you know what, you should definitely stick with Firefox. But what I'm saying is that the Edge has a kind of I don't know, a family-friendly name to it, because it's Microsoft, and because people know and trust Microsoft, and it will just be downloaded, as opposed to Mozilla Firefox, where people have to know about it to go and get it. So that's the difference. It's not a USP in the traditional way we think about it, but because it is so common by default, and let's not forget, this will get installed on pretty much it will get installed on every Windows 10 computer by updates. That is its advantage, and why it's a more important update, I would argue, than Opera or even Firefox.
But, you know, Edge has been on Windows 10 since Windows 10 came out. Current market share, Chrome 76%. Firefox 9, Internet Explorer 7, Edge 5. So just being on the desktop these days is no guarantee that people are going to take it, as Edge has proven for the last 5 years. And that version of the browser wasn't great, but again, it was sort of, it worked as a browser. If all you want to do is surf the internet, it's there. I mean, the huge advantage Chrome has got is the install base on Android, where Chrome is the default, and so people are now much more familiar with Chrome. And B, of course, the Google search engine pushes you towards Chrome at every given opportunity. People are persuadable, but not to the point where they're going to pick a nothing browser over one they're familiar with.
Well, we don't know that for sure. So you're right. I accept that as an argument. But I'd almost say let's come back in a year and see what the figures show. Because I think this will, I believe, change Edge's fortunes. Because it was one of the problems that it had is not all websites appeared as people expected websites to appear. Because it was using Edge HTML as its rendering engine. And so you didn't like that. So then you would look for an alternative. No, that's not going to be the case anymore. So, you know, I'm not saying for sure it's going to be a hit, but I am saying it is well worth everyone having a look at this, because at last Microsoft, after, you know, think about it, how many years have Microsoft been producing browsers for? And I know that it reached dominance with IE, but it was never a really good browser. This is actually a good browser based on other people's ideas, sure, based on someone else's rendering engine, fine. But it's still a good browser. Yeah, okay, that's fine. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time.
I've rarely heard such enthusiasm about any item of technology as I've just heard from Tim there.
Yeah, no, okay, all right. I'll go back into my default mode now. All right, let us move to the next story, which is with you, I believe. Yeah, Darian, it's you.
It's not really a separate story. It's kind of it's a continuation, I think, of a theme that we've touched on already, because it's also Microsoft. So we said that we were a little bit disappointed that Microsoft didn't make it easier in Edge to change your default search engine away from Bing. And that was that I felt a bit personally, you know, let down by that, because I've been praising Satya Nadella for turning Microsoft from what was previously, I would say, quite a coercive company in a way that really wanted you to use all Microsoft's own things and to keep you kind of locked in as much as possible, at the very least kind of strongly shoved in the direction of using all of its own products and services, even when they weren't very good. I thought Satya Nadella had really given it a good kind of a new philosophy of you use what you want and we'll make the best tools to support that. And to be fair, that has happened a lot. I think, you know, Microsoft has shown in its Android apps, for example, in Windows subsystem for Linux, you know, it's really, it does seem like it's changed its attitude a little bit. So leftovers like that, where it's shoving you towards Bing, leave a bit of a sour taste in the mouth. And unfortunately, news has emerged this month that there's going to be a bit more shoving going on, because as of next month, all new installations of Office 365 Pro Plus and any updates to the latest version are going to automatically install a Chrome extension, which turns Bing into your default search engine. As you can imagine, this has met with absolutely zero support from people on the internet. Microsoft's explanation is that it's a new extension they've come up with, which not only searches the internet, but also searches your SharePoint sites, your OneDrive content, your Teams content, and basically it brings together all of... Because, you know, Microsoft's got this idea, as is very clear from things like SharePoint, OneDrive and Teams, that it wants companies, it wants workers, businesses to operate in the cloud and to really erode the distinction between your data, your local data, as it were, and your cloud files and your cloud resources and your Azure repositories and who the hell knows what else. So I can sort of see its point that it wants to bring everything under this one umbrella, and when you do a search, it will search, as I say, the internet and your own content. Installing it by default, though... again, if you really want to, you can sort of defend Microsoft by saying that this is not a consumer product that they're automatically installing on everybody's Windows. It's Office 365 Pro Plus. And if you've ever installed Office 365 Pro Plus, you will know that, in fact, that installs everything by default and sets up its own standard settings without any interaction from the user at all. And that is by design, because it's supposed to be that there's an administrator who makes all these decisions on your behalf, and they decide whether you're going to get, you know, publisher or whatever, and similarly they can decide before the installation starts whether this extension is going to install and turn Bing into your default search engine. All the same, the default is yes. The administrator has to go in and change that setting, or users have to manually remove, disable the extension from Chrome. And you know, it just feels like a bit of a misstep in the current sort of climate, when Microsoft is rehabilitating its image somewhat regarding, you know, allowing people to use whatever tools they want. I feel they've handled this rather clumsily.
Barry, what's your take?
100% agree with Darren. What a stupid thing to do. It's the thing I don't get with Microsoft is, I mean, almost with Edge and the whole way it's set up its privacy settings and stuff, it's like... they almost feel like they're giving a bit up on Bing. There's nothing really to be chased there for Microsoft. It's not a massive money earner. It's never going to be a massive money earner. In many ways, I'm surprised they're even still operating Bing. And yet they're still trying to foist it onto to customers. I just, you know, what would really impress me in a browser maker these days is one that doesn't give them the ability, people the ability to change your search providers and default settings via a third-party app. If it could just be locked down from the start, and you know, you had certainty over that your choices would remain your choices, that would be a good browser to have.
Yeah, it does seem weird. It does seem counterintuitive to everything else that Microsoft has been doing. It's a shame. I know that John Honeyball has views. I know he's live listening to us on Mixlr at the moment. So if you have a decent enough equipment, John, to dial in, then please do so. But it just seems like a terrible decision. Okay, well, there's not much more to say about that then. We're all agreed. Bad move, Microsoft. Shall we move on to the next story, which is with you, Barry?
Yeah, this one's just frigging weird. So Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, has reportedly had his phone hacked, effectively, by the Saudis. I'm just going to make sure before I absolutely defame somebody in the Saudis, because apparently they've not got much money, so I'm pretty sure their lawyers are nowhere. But this was the Mohammed bin Salman, who is the Saudi Crown Prince. Apparently, now, this is all based on reports, although there is a technical report online, which I'll put the link into in Mixlr, from the cyber consultancy who investigated Bezos's phone. They've actually, Motherboard got hold of the report and published it online, and it is excellent, this report, in terms of detail, so I'll put it on there. But the basic gist of it is, somehow Bezos and our friend the Saudi Crown Prince got to know one another. The Crown Prince sent Bezos a video just out of the blue with no sort of preamble or message attached to it, that Bezos played on his phone. And then after that, sort of almost immediately after that, data started being lifted up from Bezos's phone, uploaded to somewhere they've not managed to sort of quite work out where. In fact, there's quite a lot of detail on how the data was lifted. It says that in the 6 months prior to receiving that WhatsApp video, Bezos's phone had an average of 430 kilobytes of what they call egress per day. That's data being uploaded, which is fairly typical for an iPhone. Within hours of that WhatsApp video, the egress jumped to 126 megabytes, and it went on for about 101 megabytes per day thereafter. So it seems that basically anything that was arriving on Bezos's phone was being uploaded somewhere else. This coincided with Bezos stories appearing in the US media some months later about an extramarital affair that Bezos was having at the time. And he got various messages as well from the Saudis of eventually saying, it's not us. it was all very weird. And the sort of big question is, why Bezos? Why are the Saudis targeting Bezos? Well, he is the owner. Amazon, the company, owns the Washington Post. And it's believed that the Washington Post was running a story that was critical of the Saudis. And this was possibly the motivation for getting back at Bezos by revealing what he was up to outside of his marriage.
Allegedly.
All allegedly. Although, to be fair, it looks like Bezos has come. I mean, the affair is well known. I'm assuming that this report, the sort of technical report on what's gone on in his phone, has been released with his permission. It looks like a sort of deliberate leak, because I can't imagine that kind of stuff just finds its way online by a reporter digging around. So I'm thinking Bezos wants this story out there, and it's all a bit circumstantial. But it certainly looks like the two events were linked, let's put it that way.
Okay. I think this is probably one where we better not editorialise too much. And possibly, unless you've got something to say, Darren, maybe just leave it there.
Well, just that it's kind of awesome if this is truly possible, that you can send someone. I mean, there's clearly more to this than we know. You can't just send someone a WhatsApp video and then through the act of them watching it, suddenly your phone automatically sends all your data out to a nominated third party. There's clearly something else that's going on that maybe Mr. Bezos himself didn't realise. I'm just kind of, I'm really impressed in an engineering sense that they managed to pull this off, and it really does kind of raise questions. People say, people still say, do you really need security software on your smartphone? And the fact that this is possible, I'm not suggesting that the likes of you or I are interesting enough for the Saudis to want to suck up all the data that's on our phones. But if it could happen to him, it could happen to anyone.
You say about the, you can't just play a video and have your data uploaded. In fact, months after this attack, WhatsApp issued a patch for a flaw that allowed data ingress, egress as a result of watching videos. So,
okay, so it's nearly right.
Yeah, I think this was, it definitely appears as the case. I think part of the problem for the forensic investigators was that the video that was sent, they can't analyze in great detail because WhatsApp is encrypted, so they can't get into the code base of the video to find out precisely what's going on and precisely what it's gone. So using WhatsApp as the transmission means was incredibly clever because it's encrypted by default. But
and also happened to have a big vulnerability in it.
Yeah, well, quite. Storm. I mean, And also the, and again, this is very, well, no, I think it's public knowledge, that the Saudis bought a hacking company, the Saudi prince bought a hacking company in 2018, I think it was, who are believed potentially to have been behind the attack. But again, as Tim says, I'm treading very carefully here because I don't fancy taking on the Saudi prince. And Tim asked me to do this story, and he's the offensive owner of PG.
So if you would like to read that report, rather than, you know, which is more based in fact than anything we've just said, then it is pcpro.link/podhack. So that will take you there. I'll just set up that that shortcut. pcpro.link/podhack. All right, let us move on to, well, actually, very briefly, I'll just, so BET is happening. Right now, I don't know how many really are aware of BET, but it's the Europe's biggest education technology show. It happens in London every January at about this time, so that's happening in Excel right now as we speak. And I was looking around basically for any news emerging from it, and it's mostly around Chromebooks. It's pretty much all around Chromebooks, with a couple of new ones being announced, such as from Acer and Lenovo, from the top of my head. But the interesting thing is, bearing in mind all what we started this whole discussion off about with the Sonos lack of support, Chrome is now saying that Chromebooks will have 8 years of support. And that's not just education Chromebooks, but actually all the ones that home users use as well. And you know, just a little bit of kudos to Google there, because I think that is a good move.
What do they mean by support?
Oh, okay. So what they mean by that. So there is a, so it means automatic updates for Chrome, the underlying Chrome OS. It means security updates. So security, stability, and new features. Okay. So that's what they're basically talking about.
Okay. So I was just going to say, this is very similar to what we were saying before. I mean, because the Chromebook does a lot of its, you know, a lot of the hard work happens in the cloud, it shouldn't be too difficult to enable the client devices to, you know, to just to pootle along for longer than some Sonos type companies might want them to.
Yeah. So, and just to be absolutely clear, because I wasn't just then, this extends to new devices. So this doesn't necessarily, this won't apply to old ones, but if you buy one of the devices launching in 2020, such as the Lenovo 10e Chromebook tablet and the Acer Chromebook 712, then you will get automatic updates until June 2028. So, you know, it's but it is something to look out for. If you're buying a new Chromebook in the coming months, just make sure it's released in 2020 rather than 2019.
Noted.
Okay. I did actually hear a scribble of paper, pen on paper there, though, Darren, so I don't think it was noted. So, you know, don't lie to me. All right. Final story, hot hardware of the week, and it is with you, Darian.
Yes, well, you know I love my networking things. You know I love mesh networks in particular, and you know I love 802.11ax. So you can imagine I was rubbing my hands in excitement when I got my mitts on the new Netgear Orbi Wi-Fi 6, which is a mesh networking system which uses 802.11ax. Netgear claims connection speeds of up to 1,200 megabits on the 2.4 gigahertz band and twice that on the 5 gigahertz band, and it also has a separate dedicated 5 gigahertz radio which is solely dedicated to backhaul traffic. The standard package, I should say, is only two stations, but you can buy more, and that backhaul channel is also 802.11ax rated at 2.4 gigabits per second. So it's a recipe for lovely fast Wi-Fi all over your house. So hot, yeah.
Well, it sounds hot, Darren, but I suspect there are... How much does this cost?
Oh, well, it's £750.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Lord.
I mean, I kind
how
of
many,
admire...
How many discs do you get for that?
Two. You get your base station and one satellite. Now, I do... first thing I want to say is that 802.11ax, as I've observed before, has really good penetration, better than 802.11ac. So 2 is actually more than sufficient to completely fill my home. It's claimed they have a coverage of 465 square metres. I'm not very good at visualising square metres, but that's on par
with the
kind of mesh system that you're likely to buy, yes. And I do think that... I kind of respect Netgear for not... it's not a half measure in any way. It's full 802.11ax on both bands and an 802.11ax backhaul band. So although it's super expensive, you get absolutely, you know, what you pay for with no compromises. It's also got 2.5 gigabits Ethernet in, so if you have a super, super fast internet connection, it can take advantage of that.
Yes, and how many... it's got... 4 ports on the satellite, is that right?
Yeah, 4 regular Ethernet ports on both the router and the satellite, which I think is good because wired networking is far from dead because we've all got, you know, smart hubs and things that we need to plug in still. It irritates me when companies make fairly expensive mesh networking things and then just don't provide enough sockets, so you have to invest in a switch and it's all a bit messy.
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying this is the first actually properly released mesh Wi-Fi 6 network.
Yes, absolutely. It's in a field. It's, what's the word, on a field of its own. Michael Deere has actually asked 2 quite sensible questions on Mixlr. So well,
you sound surprised that Michael would do that.
He says, how is backwards compatibility? Now, the truth is, it is not backwards compatible with old Orbi stuff, presumably because it would force the backhaul radio to drop down to 802.11ac and would ruin performance for everyone, or at least would, you know, make it rather pointless spending £750. Can it work with my G and AC stuff? Yes, all 802.11ax things are compatible with 802.11ac, 802.11n, 802.11g, and I believe if you still have an 802.11b card hanging around somewhere, it will probably work with that as well.
Okay, so let's just talk about the cost of this for a second. £750 as a Nessie exec has said, he's, or she has said, that they are freezing even before you've asked if they're hot or not. You could buy a new computer for that price.
Yeah, but it doesn't do the same job, does it?
No, and are we, is it remotely sensible to spend this much on a piece of infrastructure?
Well, you know, we're running a bit short on time, so I will just give you a straight answer. For most people, no. As I've commented, 802.11ax has good penetration as it is, and in my own house, I found that I was just as well off, literally getting the same speeds, sometimes even slightly better speeds, from a standalone 802.11ax router in my living room than from the two-node Orbi Wi-Fi 6 system distributed along the length of my house. There will certainly be scenarios where the Orbi will show its strength. I mean, if my house were twice as big, I'm certain that the Orbi would give me a big benefit at the rear of the house, but it ain't. And if my house were twice as big, then maybe I would be rich enough that £750 would be would seem like a reasonable amount to spend for what is, I mean, really, really excellent performance. I got 55 megabytes a second downstream all around my home. I mean, that's really impressive. And
I don't want to be getting 55 megabytes downstream in Croydon for that money.
Well, fine, but this is what's on offer, and it's the best and fastest mesh system there is. So, So for most people, I'd have to say this is not a thing I'd recommend. You know, if a friend just said, "Oh, my Wi-Fi is a bit weak. What should I do?" I wouldn't jump straight to the £750 Orbi Wi-Fi 6. But this section of the podcast is called Hot or Not, and this is just, you know, light years ahead of any other mesh system that I've tested, and it's and it doesn't compromise in any way, so I'm really, really rather fond of it.
Just someone commented, James Hopkin, I presume it's not for the home user. This one absolutely is targeted at the home user. It even has an attractive kind of styling to it, doesn't it?
Oh, you. Yeah, I think it looks like something out of Star Trek. It's kind of cream with a sort of brush silver effect edging and a black kind of. You have to see it really, but it really looks like they've tried to make it look futuristic. And in my view, that's failed somewhat. It doesn't look futuristic. It looks like it wants to look futuristic, but you know that's a fairly small small criticism.
Okay. All right. Well, before you and Barry, although I think I know where Barry's going to go, cast your votes. If everyone listening on Mixlr would care to say whether they think this £750 piece of mesh 802.11 AX Wi-Fi equipment is hot or not, that'd be great. In the meantime, Barry, hot or not?
You know, I'm absolutely in the market for something like this right now because I work in a sort of remote garage office. My Wi-Fi isn't good enough for I'm testing these game streaming services at the moment for a future PC Pro feature. And on some of those, the Wi-Fi is a bit wibbly on my Mac and it's not quite strong enough. So I'm definitely in the market for an AX or a mesh system, Wi-Fi 6, we should be calling it, I guess. But that price is just ludicrous. You can't 750 notes for a router effectively is monstrous. So if it comes down in price, I'm very much looking forward to it. But it would have to come down in price to you know a quarter of its current level before I'm going to start thinking about that. I'm afraid.
A quarter? Do you think that is hot or not, Darian? What do you think?
Well, I think it's definitely hot, and I think I've set out my reasons why. It's totally next gen in more than one sense.
Yep. Okay.
Day-to-day difference, it's not going to change your life, really, is it, compared to a reasonably decent AC router?
It really depends on what you're doing. I mean, a lot of AC routers, a lot of very cheap mesh systems are good enough to convey the full bandwidth of your domestic internet connection around the house. So if that's all you need, then no, you don't need to spend anything like this much money. But if you are, you know, if you've say you have a home office like I think all three of us do, and you have lots of files, like lots of big archives, lots of things that you want to move around and back up and be and you know, have nice sort of super fast remote desktoping into the machine upstairs from downstairs or whatever, then you know that the extra bandwidth you do notice it. Is it worth that much money? Probably only in a very specific case where you're making money from from your ability to move enormous files around within your home network. But, you know, I mean, it's all how much price you put on convenience for the most part, other than that. And obviously, this is very, very much an early adopter price. All 802.11ax stuff is really expensive right now. But it's the only way to get that sort of performance currently.
Hard luck for Netgear that John's not on this week, because this is definitely Hannibal-grade hardware, I'd say.
Yes, I think he might be interested in it. He'd be disappointed it hasn't got 10 gigabit Ethernet, though, I imagine.
Yes. All right. I think I'm with everyone. It's really hot technology, but the price is way wrong. And there are other 802.11ax mesh systems on the horizon, including Netgear's own, a Nighthawk version, which is going to be around £250. So it definitely, I would not rush to buy this. So what's an overall hot for the technology, cold for the price? Should we agree?
Well, I think that's quite reasonable. I mean, it is hot hardware, not affordable hardware, so I'm going to take that as a win.
Okay, but I'm afraid if you include the votes from Mixlr, then it is largely cold. David Artis, cold, very fast and great tech, but too expensive right now. Russ Reed, stone cold. Potster, cold. Ian Orford, though, is saying, good innovation. I look forward to buying one for £150 in 3 years.
I think it might be six, but you could probably get one for 300 in 3 years.
And just to finish with Zed Morrow, hot, I wish I could justify one, but it is just too dear. All right. Actually, before we go, can I just quickly say the new issue? Well, it's not so new anymore, but the issue of PC Pro is currently out. So if you're running Windows 7 or someone you know is running Windows 7, we pretty much include everything you need to know in this magazine. We call it a rescue kit. It's written by Barry, and he explains the three options you have available if you are still using Windows 7. An excellent group test of NAS drives written by Memory memory by you. No, it's not you, but it's
Stuart.
Stuart Andrews. Sorry. It's even better than I thought. and you know, various other excellent articles in there, which I won't go into detail, but go and buy it. All right. Thank you, everyone. Until our next podcast in 2 weeks' time, when we hope to have John Honeyball back with us in the virtual studio. Goodbye.
Bye.